Wilkes-Barre, Times Leader. The Evening News, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Tuesday, June 1st, 1920. The Ruthermometer. Babe's homer pace is faster than in 1919, but untouted rivals are pushing him. Babe Ruth in the afternoon game between the Yankees and Washington at the Polo Grounds yesterday before a crowd of 38,688 batted out his 12th home run by Dean Snyder. Introducing the latest instrument in baseball, the Ruthermometer. It registers Babe Ruth's temperature. When batting fever rises, he cracks the ball out of the park. It's a low day when the big Bambino fails to connect. Yankee fans are impatient with these low days. They think he ought to carry a high every day. They often yell when he steps to the plate, "Show 'em high fever, babe," leading 1919 pace. Ruth made his 12th home run yesterday against the Tigers, with Danes doing the serving. He is ahead of his 1919 schedule. It was not until July 5th that he cut the 8th notch in his war club last year. His start this season was late, too. His first joy wallop he made in 1919 was on April 23rd, and in 1920, it was May 1st before he began to do what New York bought him to do. Ruth is partial to southpaw pitching, 5 of his 8 being off left-handers. They are Panic, Kerr, Williams, Wildman, and Leonard. All of his full-circuit hits have been made at the Polo Grounds. He caroms the ball into the upper deck of the right field stands. The barrier is a little closer here than at the Red Sox park. They howled a little when Huggins paid $137,000 for the Demon of Swatters. All that is forgotten now. He earns his gold. Ty Cobb used to be a drawing card in New York, but he's a second-rater compared to the Babe this year. When Babe bunts at a triple, the crowd sinks back in dismay. They want him all out of the lot. Babe is having some rivalry, however, in Happy Felsch of the White Sox and Tilly Walker of the Athletics. But Ruth isn't worried. Neither are the Polo Ground fans. They're proud and jealous of their idol. Babe is earning his Yankee stipend, even though it be King's ransom. Ruth's true rivals in SWAT race. Happy Felsch. There is nothing like a little competition to make things hum, and Babe Ruth is getting it. Happy Felsch of the White Sox has made 6 homers, and so has Tilly Walker of the Athletics. Pitchers whom he has made his record off are Leverett, St. Louis, Caldwell, Cleveland, Mays, New York, Russell, Boston, and Naylor, Philadelphia. Tilly Walker. Walker's victims are Zachary, Washington, with 2. Douse, Detroit, Bagby and Caldwell, Cleveland, and Wilkinson, Chicago. Tilly is so fast he can stretch triple into a home run if the fielders aren't on their toes. 5 of Felsch's blows have come when there was no one on the bases ahead of him.
Hey everybody, Podsman Josh here. On this week in 1920s baseball, I got fellow Podsman Matthew on the line. How you doing, Matt?
Hey, Sweetbread, what's going on?
Wait, am I Sweetbread? I thought I was Bucketfoot. I thought you were Sweetbread.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Bucketfoot or Puddinhead. Yeah.
Not Puddinhead.
That's Puddinhead Jones.
Puddinhead Jones is a good name.
Yeah.
I was going to be Specs or maybe Bucketfoot. I think you should be Sweetbread. I mean, that's
okay,
pretty
I'll
good.
Be Sweetbread.
I know that's not what you were intending, but now it's there. Now it's stuck. Yeah, Sweetbread. I think when I mentioned Sweetbread And I thought it was Sweetbread Martin, but it was Speed Martin and Sweetbread Bailey, both pitchers for the Cubs. Two really good nicknames.
Ah, just great. Yeah, I'm honored. I'm honored to be Sweetbread.
Yeah, too. Sweetbread. That's really good. And you kind of are a foodie. I mean, if we want to get, you know, get off topic, I mean, yeah, you have that reputation around the office.
I like food and I eat it. Yeah, no, definitely.
Well, it's possibly going to be before too long that we can record in person again as Pennsylvania moves out of its most strict lockdown phase of the COVID pandemic. It's of course raining outside again today, as it always is.
Yeah, we can only record when it's raining, apparently. So but you're welcome. Yeah.
Yes. But yeah, so we're excited about a little bit of a possible return to normalcy, and the fans of 1920 are excited. I mean, the fans of this podcast are excited. But also, as we take you in the time machine back to 100 years ago, as you heard from that opening article, the Ruthometer? Is that how I say that?
I think so. Yeah.
Ruthometer?
Ruthermometer?
The Ruthermometer?
Ruthermometer? Yeah.
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 The excitement around the Babe is heating up. He started a little bit with, I mean, he started out with a slow April. I mean, he didn't hit any home runs in April at all. So we'll get into the Babe's, that's going to be the focus of our topic today is the Babe and his May and early June and how excited people are getting. But before we do that, let's set the standings. Let's tell everybody where our American League and National League pennant chase is standing here as we enter a new month of the 1920 season. So what do you got, Matthew? You got the standings, I know.
Yeah, so I got this is through today. Of course, that was a Saturday. So through Saturday, June 5th, 1920. We'll start again with the junior circuit, the American League. And no surprise there, we have Trispeakers Indians leading the pack, 27-15. So they're still doing really well. We have a little bit of a newcomer to that top tier, the Yankees. They've been hot since we recorded last. They're at 27-16, just a half game back. Hmm. Boston is still doing pretty well, but they've fallen off a little bit, 3.5 out. White Sox, again, that really talented, you know, defending pennant winning Chicago White Sox. They're 23-19, 4 out. And then the Senators are actually doing pretty well. At least they're a little bit above 500 at 21-20, 5.5 out. And then the big drop-off to kind of our basement dwellers for the year. The Browns, the Athletics, and the Tigers are all well below 500 and rounding it out there. So in the National League, we still have those surprising Brooklyn Robins, Brooklyn Dodgers, Super Boss. They have a lot of nicknames.
So many.
Yeah. They are tied with the Reds and our favorite power-hitting first baseman. What was his name again?
Jake Daubert.
Yeah, Jake Daubert.
Yeah,
So they're doing well.
Schmoiken.
From Schmoiken, Pennsylvania. So they're tied, 24-15 for the Robins, 25-16 for the Reds.
Ooh, a tie.
Yeah. We have the Cubs starting to play well, 24-20, 2.5 out. Pittsburgh, who I think was doing really well last time we recorded, they've fallen off a little bit. They're back down to an even 19-19 at 4.5 out.
They were in first place for a hot minute there.
Yeah, I think they were either in first or they were tied for first or, yeah. They were right there. So, unfortunately, I think we might have jinxed them and we did an episode on them.
Yep.
So, and then we have the Cardinals at 21-22. You know, the National League is a bit more even than the American League. We have the Braves, the Boston Braves, 18-22. Again, the Giants aren't having a great year, 18-23. And then we have the lowly Philadelphia Phillies, our favorite Phillies, in the basement at 15-27. So there's your rundown, June 5th, 1920.
All right. And, you mentioned that the Yankees are moving up in the standings. And obviously from that article, we mentioned that the fans are getting real excited about the Babe and hitting home runs. I found another interesting article just to give you this quick sense of, like, how excited people were. So this is about a game at the Polo Grounds, May 31st, 1920. The official attendance, well, let me start from the beginning. It says, the greatest crowd that ever sandwiched into the Polo Grounds today went hysterical when Babe Ruth banged out his 12th home run of the season in the eighth inning of the second game of the Memorial Day doubleheader. The official attendance was 38,688, which tops the record. Even the World Series games that the Giants had been in previous years didn't have that many fans. So that's a Memorial Day game. Just to see Babe hitting dingers was more fans than had come to the World Series in previous years. It says there was a band to furnish musical doings between the first and second servings of baseball today. So it was a doubleheader. They had a band. They had a packed crowd. This says the crowd was simply nutty over Babe Ruth and had no time for anything else but him and his clouting. So I just thought that was a nice piece of writing and a nice piece of historical flavor to really picture the packed crowd. They had to turn thousands of people away from just a regular season game because Babe was hitting them out. And there was bands playing and there was records breaking. And yeah, they had said they had to turn away thousands of paying customers to try to get in. And it said they even had to turn away people who were trying to hover around and peek in. It says they had to turn away all the spectators on the grounds. Every inch of space in the stands was leased for the afternoon. So we are really getting into the thick of Babe Ruth mania here in end of May, beginning of June. 1920. Did you know that Babe hit zero home runs in the month of April? So it started in the middle of the month, but he did not start out. This is a big, big record breaking year for him, but he didn't start out hitting any in April. Do you know who he hit his first ones of the year against?
I'm guessing. I'm guessing it maybe against his former club.
That's correct. I think he was saving his clouts for his former club. He hit one on May 1st and one on May 2nd when they played against the Red Sox. And then he had a two home run game on May 11th. He had another one on May 12th and six in the last week of May. So 12 for the month of May. So that's when the Ruthometer got really heated. Looking ahead through the rest of the year, he had 11 in June, 13 in July. One day in June, he had three homers because it was a doubleheader. He had two in one game and one in the other. And then he had his biggest month of the year of 13 in July. August, it looks like he played fewer games, but he had seven homers. And then in the month of September, he had a hot end of the last week of the year, and he ended with 54 home runs, 10 in the month of September. So 54 home runs was so far and away breaking the previous record.
Yeah, it was like, what, 29 the previous year, I want to say?
Yeah, it was his own record of 29. You know, there's some debate as to whose record he broke. It's surprising that such a thing could be debated. But there was a season where some historians kind of like don't count the record because at that time it was a stadium in Chicago. It had a super short porch in left. Balls hit there always counted as doubles. And then for one year in 1884, they decided to count them as home runs. And everyone on the White Sox that year, who were called the White Stockings, for it was a more formal time, everyone on the White Stockings had in 1884, not everyone, but many, many players had 20 home runs, which was totally unheard of. Ned Williamson, who was not a great power hitter, had 27, which theoretically stood as the record until Ruth hit 29. Some historians don't count that because it was this fluke year where everything hitting the air to left was a homer. And some people give the credit to, do you know who some other historians give the credit to before Babe broke it? Our man in Philadelphia?
Home run Baker?
No, Gravy Cravings.
Gabby Kravath.
Yeah, Gabby Kravath, by some historians, had the non-tainted record of most home runs in a single season prior to Babe Ruth. So Ned Williamson kind of stands officially in the record books, but that 1884 year was a fluke season with the short porch and change in the rules. So then Gravy Cravings had a decent, I forget the number off the top of my head, but his record was standing for a few years until the Babe's big 1919, which seems like a small year compared to the Babe's 1920, because he had 29 in 19, which was a good year, still a good year. But then he had 54 in 1920, which was just ridiculous.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think like, you know, we started off this podcast with the Babe, and I apologize to all your Babe fans out there that we've taken this long to come back to him. But I think, yeah, like, I think what you're saying about like the attendance and the stands, like, I think it's hard. I mean, at least, I don't know about you, but like me growing up, the Babe was a mythic figure when I was a child. But I think he can get drowned out sometimes nowadays with all the other stars in baseball history and sports history. But I don't think it can be understated how popular he was, right?
Right.
Like, he just was the most...
He was everything.
popular. I mean, I think he just, it was like, what would be a good comparison? Michael Jordan? I mean, like I don't even know.
Like a combination of pop star, movie star, sports star. Like there was a lot. Obviously, people's attention was a lot less fractured. And there weren't, you know, a million channels on TV or anything. There was, broadcasting was really broadly cast. And sports and baseball was the one. And Babe was, yeah, he was like everything. He was in movies. He was on vaudeville. He was like the combination of every, probably was like Michael Jordan. I mean, movies, commercials, all the things that Jordan did. And, but in it, you know, even more, what would you say, like entertainment deprived time, Babe could just become this extraordinary hero.
I'm thinking about his career. I'm just thinking about, and just this year, like the pressure. It's unfathomable to me that he could perform so well. You know, he gets sold, he gets sold to the rival Yankees. He's playing in a city that is notorious throughout history for destroying, you know, the Yankees or whoever would get a star marquee player. And then they would, and inevitably that, thinking like someone like Danny Tartable, you know, in the 90s, they would get a star player and then, you know, they would get on the Yankees or the Mets and they would just wilt, you know. And here the Babe is, he gets sold and he's thriving, you know. And he knows, I mean, he's literally probably mobbed by fans every day. By kids.
And he didn't want to go. He had his business interest in Boston. He had his life in Boston. He had his family in Boston. He didn't want to go.
And didn't Miller have to go out to, Miller Huggins have to go out to, it was Miller Huggins, right? That I'm thinking of, that went out to Los Angeles to convince him to come back East.
Yeah, I think so.
Start,
yeah.
Like
in the preseason.
Yeah, he probably was going to start like a cigar business or something.
He was a holdout essentially. And the amount of money was so much more than anyone else that itself is a pressure of the price tag. I mean,
yeah.
He does not seem to be fazed by it. Some people just, and of course he came from nothing, you know? I mean, maybe Elvis Presley is a closer example than Michael Jordan, you know?
I think I know you're right. Or the Beatles.
He came from nothing and rose to this, yeah, literally, like, not literally, but almost literally mythic status. Like, he seems like a myth. Like, he seems like a made-up person. He seems like a fictional character, not a real man, so.
Speaking of mythical feats, I don't know if it's time, but you were going to talk about, you know, him hitting on June 1st, right? Or in all his, I mean, there's just pitching exploits as well.
Yeah, so if you remember, in 1919, he was still a pretty good pitcher and regularly used. That's when he started to be transitioned to the outfield a lot more because they knew they needed his bat in the lineup more than every fourth or fifth day. When he came to the Yankees, they just decided they weren't going to use him to pitch at all. But there must have been some limit even to the abuse that a 1920 pitcher's arm could take, because the Yanks had back-to-back doubleheaders, I think, or two doubleheaders in 3 days at the end of May. And so come June 1, some pitchers, they didn't have anybody to go. Babe stepped up and offered to start the game for the Yanks. So that's his one pitching appearance of 1920, and he did it on June 1st. He got the start. He got the win. He batted cleanup. He then moved to the outfield, got two hits and a walk, including a double, and the Yanks won big against Chicago. So that was a awesome performance to just having – I mean, he wasn't completely dominant as a pitcher. The Yankees had a big offensive day, so it was kind of easy enough for them to get the win. He only pitched 4 innings, but they gave him the credit for the win, as was custom at the time. He batted fourth, and then to be the starting pitcher, to hit cleanup, to get two hits and a walk and a double, to get the W, and then go back and play 5 more innings in the outfield. I mean, that's no wonder.
You mentioned to me like you couldn't believe how few times this had actually happened. So we did a little bit of research, and there's like only been one other time since then that a pitcher has hit cleanup, and it was like in relief. It was like some sort of double switch or some sort of rule.
Well, so I don't have to look this up a little more, but in 2016, it looks like the A's Kendall Graveman started the game as the cleanup hitter, because I think what happened was the DH had got scratched after the lineup was submitted, but before the game started. And somehow when that happens in the American League, you lose your DH. And so they just slotted the pitcher into the fourth spot. It was not because he was a good hitter. It was some weird injury / lineup fluke slash DH rule that I don't totally understand. But didn't you also say Don Larson hit really high in the order for the Dodgers?
So, yeah, we did a little bit of research. And again, we're going to have to do more, I think. And what I read was that, yeah, so I read that Don Larson also hit fourth, but he actually went to figure out why. It was like, did somebody lose a bet? He actually played left field in 1961. For the Kansas City Athletics, who were terrible at the time. He played left field and hit fourth. And it was, I think, his only, you know, non-pitching batting performance of the year or something like that. Really strange. And he went like 0-for-4.
So he did that.
Why was he in left field and hitting fourth that day? I have no idea.
But he did it. He did it not as a starting pitcher. But still, when you see the lineup and you see Don Larson hitting fourth, you're like, what the heck is happening? And that was the starting lineup. It wasn't like a weird switch. It was
Maybe. And according to this other article that we found, you know, Ruth actually had he actually was hitting fourth a lot in 1919 with the Sox. 13 of his starts he hit fourth. There was another, he's the only pitcher to ever hit, according to this, anything other than ninth in a World Series game.
That's interesting.
And he's also the only pitcher in Major League history to pitch a shutout while batting cleanup in 1919.
I mean, that's like Little League stuff when you hit fourth and pitch and throw a shutout.
You know, I'm thinking of, obviously, the Ohtani is the one that comes to mind in recent memory. You know, because I think didn't we talk another episode about these two-way players and how exciting they are?
Yeah, and it was obviously more common at the time. I'm pretty interested in Smokey Joe Wood. I want to do some more research on him because he was a phenomenal pitcher, one of the few 30-game winners in Major League Baseball history.
At this point, he's on the Indians, right? And he's playing outfield. Maybe I'm wrong in that.
Nope. Like that's correct. Yep,
a
that's
full-time correct. Position player. And then another surprising thing that we found out was, we didn't even realize this, that George Sisler watch, when he came up for the first few years, he pitched a lot.
And yeah, I had
was
no
a really
idea.
Good pitcher. And I had no idea that either. So
then became a first baseman, which is not where you stick a guy with a good arm.
Yeah, what a waste. No, but obviously he's in the middle of a phenomenal season. Yeah, he it looks like he is as recently as 1918, he pitched a complete game shutout against Walter Johnson, winning 1-0. So
wow. And I wonder,
and he was hitting third that day.
Nice. Sisler, he doesn't get the credit he deserves. I think that we're writing that historical wrong.
Yeah,
way to go. Way to go, us. Yes. Spread the word. Sisler watch. So I was interested by some of the other names in that Ruthometer article. I thought that was pretty neat to see some of the two names that they showed. So that article obviously came out right at the beginning of June. So as we mentioned, Babe didn't do a lot in April, got hot in May. So here at the beginning of June, he's not like blowing away the field with 10 times as many homers as everybody else. I mean, there are some guys chasing him. So who are they, Matthew? Who are these other two fellows?
So I think I mentioned them in that little intro. So one of them is Tilly Walker, who at this point I think is on St. Louis.
That's a name I've never heard.
I apologize. He's actually with the Philadelphia Athletics at this point.
So he'd been on four teams. He was on Washington. He was on the Browns. He was on the Boston Americans.
All of these guys, we keep mentioning this. Every time we do research on any of these old players, it's amazing. Number one, the amount of research that has been done, which is, I mean, there's always more to do, but it's amazing some of the research that has been done on these old ballplayers. And number two, how fascinating their lives and careers are. So Tilly has this mythical status of growing up in the backwoods of Tennessee, strengthening his arm, throwing rocks. He had apparently a phenomenal outfield arm, like a legendary arm. He was a power hitter for years, obviously in the dead ball era. He had a league-leading 30 assists in 1914.
Wow. As an outfield player?
As an outfield player.
Yeah, I guess 30 would be bad if you're an infielder, but that's really good if you're an outfielder.
That's phenomenal, isn't it? Like, yeah, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but isn't like usually in single digits nowadays?
Yeah, if you have 10, you're in the league, I think, yeah. So that's amazing. I just happened to notice, looking at his player page, that he did lead the league in home runs in 1918, but that was with a whopping 11. Yeah. 1917, he only had two, and then in 1918, he got traded to came to play in Philadelphia, maybe a more conducive ballpark, but he hit 11.
And then, spoiler alert, he's not going to challenge the Babe for the 1920 total. Pretty interesting.
Now he's going to fall off a little bit, but he's going to finish with 17. Yeah, I mean, he had a decent little career, definitely. But the other player that probably the player that's more remembered in history is Happy Felsch, who we'll probably talk a lot more about later in the season because of how integral he is to the Black Sox scandal. So Happy Felsch was the center fielder for the 1919 White Sox. He grew up in a family of 12 in Milwaukee from a German immigrant family and was this incredible athlete from a young age. He was a wrestler, baseball player. He played, I think he swam. I think he played a lot of sports. So he was a pretty famous like minor league player for a while. So I think he was like a roofer sider working in his early 20s and playing in the minor league teams in Milwaukee. Eventually was discovered and purchased. It was kind of like, I think, a bidding war for him at one point. Quickly ascended to one of the top tier players in the American League. He actually was the one, I believe, that made a statement and confessed. So he, whether or not it was something that was coerced out of him, or whether or not he just wanted to open up about it, apparently somebody showed up with like a bottle of scotch and got him to confess. So he actually, after, you know, after a few players had already been implicated, he came out publicly and admitted to the whole thing, as that's when things really started to get heated up.
What a bummer, right? Because in this year, 1920, 14 home runs, which
having a great year. He is one of the premier players in the major leagues at this point. He's this great center fielder. He's a huge star both in Chicago and his hometown of Milwaukee, where he's absolutely loved. You know, at this point, he's considered the greatest player ever come from Milwaukee, which I thought it was interesting. Like, they call it Cream City, which I guess is a nod to the dairy production.
I think so.
That's just great. Cream City. It's just a great, great name. So yeah, I mean, he's doing pretty well salary wise, but you know, Charles Comiskey, again, this is going to come up again and again. Charles Comiskey is a notorious penny pincher, and he's not really paying a lot of his players. He's paying Eddie Collins really well. Eddie Collins is getting like $15,000 a year, the second baseman in the Hall of Famer, Eddie Collins. But his stars, Joe Jackson, Happy Felsch, others like Eddie Ciccotti are not even getting $5,000 a year. So there's a big, big gap. And a lot of the gambling money supposedly is, a lot of this fix is just, it's just about money, unfortunately.
Sure.
No excuse for it, obviously. But there are obviously other circumstances going on at the time.
Again, we'll get into a little later, but if you look back at the 1919 World Series, some people point out that Joe Jackson played pretty well in the 1919 World Series. Happy Felsch did not. I mean,
Happy Felsch made some miscues in the outfield.
Just dropping easy flies. Yeah. I mean, just full on just booting routine plays.
I want to say he hit like 190, somewhere around there. Now there is, and again, this is dramatized in that movie, 8 Men Out, and he's played by Charlie Sheen, a young Charlie Sheen in, I think it was like a 1988 movie. There is the argument that he made at some point that, you know, a lot of his hits were like really well hit, and they just were hit at people, or there were some really great plays by like Ed Rusch and some of the other Cincinnati outfielders. But, you know, Happy ends up being many years later an integral source. And I forget the name of the author, I apologize, for the 8 Men Out book, which then becomes the movie later on. But you know, the book I think was published in the 1960s. And at the time, Happy was, I think, the only surviving member that would talk, or the only surviving member of the Black Sox that the author could really talk to and get a hold of. And at that point, he just opened up and admitted to a lot of things. Of course, it's one person. It's their one account. Yeah,
but what a bummer.
What a bummer, because he was this incredible star. I think Ty Cobb at one point was quoted as saying he was the best center fielder in the game.
He ended the year, and again, I know batting averages and everything. If someone's batting average is really good or really bad, then that will tell you something. In addition to other stats, paints a bigger picture. But he hit .338 this year in 1920, 14 home runs, which was up there in the league leaders, 115 RBIs, which is again dependent sort of on your team, but really a good year by any standards. And obviously, as the ball started to change and the rules started to change, it was really easy to imagine another, you know, decade of Hall of Fame level performances by Happy Felsch. But of course, 1920 was his last year. He's one of the guys
prime. He's 28, turns 29 later in the year. Yeah. And he is just coming in. I think he's got maybe 4 or 5 good years left, probably.
So in this article, obviously, there's no hint of any wrongdoing. It's just like, hey, here's Happy Felch. Here's a guy who's hitting dingers. And by the end of the year, he'd be banned by Kennesaw Mountain Landis. He'd be banned for life. So this is his last season. So these are the final sort of salad days of Happy Felch. He's chasing the babe for the home run race. But
and we'll probably get into him a little bit more, too, because there's a lot of really fascinating stuff, like stuff about private detectives being hired and breaking into their apartment and looking for high purchase gifts. You know, Comiskey was doing all sorts of crazy things. Yeah, really. I mean, the Black Sox scandal, we could do an entire entire whole series just on that. So we'll get into Happy, I think, a little bit more at a later date.
I do know, like you mentioned, the money. I mean, he got probably twice as much in bribe money as he got in salary.
Yeah, so, I mean, he was making, making like $27.50 or something like that, and he got about $5,000 for fixing the series. There was supposed to be more, apparently, but they got...
It's not like they were given a few, he threw the World Series for $5,000. You're like, that's ridiculous. But yeah, this was 1920 money, where ballplayers made nothing.
Now, the other thing is that at the time, the World Series bonuses were quite significant when you compare them to their salaries. So I think in 1919, it was about $3,300 or so for the winner and about $2,500 or so for the loser. So that in and of itself, they were getting paid for that as well. Almost, I mean, it's, I think the winning, yeah, the share of the winners was more than their actual salary. So I think he very quickly was one of the ones that regretted it.
Interesting, though. Like the players were definitely, I mean, talk about motivation to win the series. It's now it's like, I'm not saying players don't care, but then it was like your livelihood. I mean, even in the pennant, I believe if you finished, I forget how, where exactly the breakoff, the cutoff was, but I think essentially if you finished in the top half of the standings, there was a little bonus. Okay. So if you won the pennant, there was money. If you won the World Series, there was money. But if your team came in second or third, there was money too. So there was a lot more competitive drive down the stretch. Like some games that might've seemed like they meant nothing. If it meant you came in second instead of third, that meant something to these guys. It was money and they were really lowly paid. So,
and you can see why gambling could really get its hands in there because of all the, let's say the lowly Browns, you know, were playing a team that was in second place, you know, maybe a gambler would come and say, okay, we'll lay down this so this team could, you know what I mean? Like just, you could just imagine all the scenarios where there was games being fixed at the time.
And for what seems like a sort of comically low amount of money was still very significant to the guys at the time. So yeah, so that was cool. I was glad to learn a little bit about Happy Felch, glad to learn a little bit about Tilly Walker. Glad to see that the Ruth-thometer is really picking up and players are really appreciating the extraordinary season that the babe is starting to put together. I'm glad that we got to mention the Sisler watch in terms of his pitching. That's that was a surprising twist.
Yeah, do we have an update on Sisler? Sisler watch. I'm looking forward to hearing it. Every time I hear it, it makes me laugh.
So here we are on June 5th, and Sisler is hitting 360. So he's got the average up a few points. He had 1, 2, 3, 4 multi-hit games in a row. He had 4 hits in the second game of a doubleheader on May 31st. He went hitless in the... Oh, no, he had 1 hit in the first game. So he had 4 hits on, well, 5 hits combined on the two games on the 31st. And they had 2 hits on June 2nd, 2 hits on June 3rd, 2 hits on June 4th. And so
he is heating up. Look at this.
So that gets the average up to 360. And then he takes the over for one day. Then he has a 4 hit day coming up actually tomorrow. Oh, no, 5 hits because it's a doubleheader. So on June 6th, he ends up with 5 hits over the 2 games, gets the average up to 370. And then he has a 3-hit game, and then he has a 4-hit game and a big romp when they beat Washington 15-1. And that's when the average gets up to 392. And then he takes the over, but then has 2 more romps where they score 15 in this game, and then 8, and then 15, and then 11, and then 10, and then 12. So their whole team is really hitting. But he has a 4-hit game, including a home run, This gets us into next week, but that puts his average up to 400. So
yeah, not to get ahead, but his June is unreal.
Crazy. He's hitting 434 is where it peaks at. I think we are ready to wrap up this week in 1920s baseball.
Yeah, the rain has stopped, so we're going to have to sign off.
I'm hoping maybe we can get back in the studio and do some in-person podcast, maybe with our masks on, but still before the All-Star break, maybe we'll be in there. Did they have All-Star games in 1920?
I think the first one was in the 30s. That famous one of those ones with the famous Carl Hubble, I think it was Carl Hubble, striking out Gehrig, Ruth, and Greenberg in order. I think that's nice. Or maybe it was Jimmy Fox, actually.
Three great ones for sure.
Yeah.
Let's pick our All-Star teams, though, anyway. Let's pick our All-Star game. We'll figure out what we'll pick the middle of the season, and we'll pick our own All-Star game, our All-Star teams.
Let's do it. Now, I'm going to give you Sisler's batting average in June. Can you guess what Sisler hit in June?
So not at the end of June, but you mean for isolated
just for the month of June?
410?
526.
What? He hit over 500 for the month?
Yeah. Wow. That might be the greatest month in terms of batting average. We'll have to look that up at some point. We'll find out. Or maybe the greatest month in batting average history.
He had a lot of three-hit games. I mean, that's you have to hit 500.
60 hits.
60 hits so. In a month.
He has a really, really great September, October as well. So we'll look forward to that. Yeah.
He cools down. He cools a little bit. It drops under four by the end of July. But he gets heated up again. Our man George Sisler. Well, we intended to focus on the Babe, but somehow we got distracted by Sisler. But can't overstate how great the Babe was, and we will pick it up next time.
We will.
Be good, sweet bread.
All right, bucket foot. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Show 'em high fever, babe.